The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, we're on Amazon Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, other podcast platforms. We would love it if you subscribe. We'd love it even more if you're so inclined, if you leave a review. We are under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. We're on Facebook, Writers on Writing KUCI. We both have websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. We have been going, God, since the late 90s. So you can imagine there are hundreds, actually probably thousands of interviews up there. And so you can't miss us. You can find all of those in our archives. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, publishing, whatever comes up. Today, we are spending time with a debut novelist, which I love because her path into publishing is recent and fresh. So for those of you out there who are embarking on first novels yourselves, hopefully we'll get to hear at least one woman's story this morning of how that's done. This is one of those family saga novels full of family secrets. So we'll get to delve into all of those too. Well, we're not going to give away secrets, but we're going to talk about secrets. Born in the Bronx and raised in Manhattan, Tracy Lang comes from a large Irish family with a few secrets of its own. She headed west and graduated from the University of New Mexico before owning and operating a behavioral healthcare company with her husband for 15 years. While writing this debut novel, We Are the Brennans, she completed the Stanford University online novel writing program. She currently lives in Bend, Oregon. We Are the Brennans came out last month. It is published by Celadon Books. We're going to talk about all of it. Tracy, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Before we dive into the book, I'd love to just talk about your path into fiction, because it sounds like you kind of had another life before becoming a novelist. So tell me a little bit about, was being a writer the dream as you were growing up, or how that all came about?
Well, I've always been attracted to writing. I was a voracious reader, even as a little kid, kind of always had my nose in a book. And so writing definitely appealed to me. I think for a long time, though, I just didn't really think I had the creative skills for that. I just seemed, maybe because I was such a fan of books and writers, I thought, I don't know if that's something I can do. And so I did sort of head in another direction for a while, mostly the behavioral healthcare business. But when I do look back on most of the jobs that I had, and including the business my husband and I owned, writing was such a big part of it. Not creative writing much, but whether it was sort of legalese, or, you know, we had contracts with the government or policy procedure as owners of the company. But a large portion of what I did for years was write assessments for our various clients and the families we worked with, which really is, in essence, telling people's stories. So I know all of that sort of fed my love for writing and certainly improved my skills. But when we were able to extricate ourselves from that business about 6 or 7 years ago, that's when I decided to jump full time into novel writing. So it was always there, and a lot of the work I did certainly fed it. But it's just been the last few years that I immersed myself in the whole process.
I don't know kind of the full parameters of behavioral healthcare, but it strikes me that there's a little bit of human psychology involved in it, and human behavior, perhaps. And all of that would be hefty fruit, I think, for a novelist.
Definitely. We worked with children, adolescents, adults, with dealing with all sorts of diagnoses across the board. So we certainly got an inside look into many, many, many families and how it all works. And so, yes, it definitely fed what I'm doing now.
Yeah, I wondered about, like, do you just feel like you kind of absorb life like that, your experiences like that, kind of into your writerly DNA? Or did you feel like there were people who you encountered, confidentiality and
sure,
changing the facts around the edges, but were there people that kind of stood out that you're like, that would be kind of an interesting case study for a book?
I think it's different pieces of different people's stories. I've always been so interested in kind of what what motivates people and what drives people and there's relationships. And so I've certainly taken note, not just from families we worked with, but my own extended family. And although this book is not based on my story or, you know, anyone in my family, none of the characters or events, but all of that, I always kind of took note, and I observe a lot. And I like to look at what makes people tick. So yeah, I certainly would note various situations, and then you end up changing them or adapting them. But yeah, there's so much out there every day and all the people we meet.
No kidding. The old Tolstoy quote about all happy families are happy in the same way, and every unhappy family is
absolutely
unhappy in a different way, right? Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'll let you set the stage for the novel. You'll do a better job than I will, and we can jump off, but kind of take us into the scope of the Brennan family and, you know, introduce us to a couple of these characters, and then we can use that as a jumping off place.
So We Are the Brennans is about an Irish Catholic family from Westchester, New York. And they've always been a pretty tight crew, arguably a little too much in each other's business at times. But the story sort of centers around Sunday Brennan, who is the only girl of four siblings. And when the story opens, she's actually living across the country in Los Angeles. She left her family and fiance at the time years ago, ostensibly for a job opportunity, but she left sort of suddenly and with little explanation, kind of threw everybody for a loop. And so flash forward 5 years, the story opens and she actually gets into a pretty bad drunk driving accident that she causes, and she kind of gets pretty beat up. So her big brother, Denny, flies out to check on her and ends up convincing her to come home for a while to recuperate and just be around family. And although everybody's excited to have her back and they're all happy to be reunited, her homecoming kicks up a lot of turmoil. So there's questions and some resentment come to the surface for everyone about why she left the way she did. And then there's the high school sweetheart fiance she's sort of abandoned, who is now married with a son, but he's her brother's business partner. He's kind of part of the family, so he's very present. So she's sort of dealing with that. And basically the longer Sunday's home, the more she realizes that her brothers and her dad maybe aren't doing as well as she assumed. And so really her homecoming starts to just kind of unravel a lot of secrets, including what drove her away years ago. And all of the Brennans are really forced to confront their own mistakes from the past, including her dad. Some of these secrets kind of are generational. So her homecoming kind of brings all that to the surface, and they have to sort of deal with it if they're going to get through it together.
So your point of entry as writer, not as the reader encounters it, but your point of entry being interested in the novel was Sunday, or was it a situation, or was it a lot of writers tell me they start with an image of something. Kind of what was the trigger for you?
It was a very kind of snippet of a situation, the idea of someone coming back into the family fold after being gone for a number of years. That was really it. But right after that, I nailed down some characters, and I did start with Sunday. I liked the idea that she would be the only girl and have kind of a different role and perspective than everybody else in the family. And then I knew that I wanted her to have at least a couple brothers. Honestly, Denny was the second character. And then it just kind of grew from there. And then I loved the idea of him having, of Cale, this kind of honorary Brennan of sorts, that's Denny's best friend. And so it did start with that little situation. And then I quickly nailed down some of the characters. And then questions just began to ask themselves. Why did she leave? What's bringing her back? You know, how's that going to impact the family and her ex-fiance? So it kind of grew from there.
And was it was always going to be a multi-point of view novel?
Yes, it started that way from the beginning. And I didn't know there'd be so many points of view. I just kind of ran with it. And I thought at some point, someone would tell me, you got to cut back on these points of view, whether it was my writer's group that I work very closely with, or when I presented it to my agent, the woman who became my agent, and even when it went to Celadon, I thought at some point, you know, someone might say that this might get a little confusing. There's a lot of voices here, but it felt right. And I just went with it, and I figured, okay, if someone tells me that along the line, then I'll take a look at that. But all of those voices were there from the first draft.
I don't think it ever felt overwhelming or confusing. I think there's probably six voices. I think that's what I counted.
There are, yeah, seven. the three main voices and then three kind of secondary voices.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes, that's true. That's six.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So even I have to think.
I know. Yeah. I was lying in bed the other night going, okay, one, two.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
well, but, and one person only gets one chapter and a couple people only get two, you know, so yeah, I definitely had to think about that for a second, but it's six voices. Yeah.
Right. And I want to get into talking about minor characters because I always think it's very interesting how much a writer needs to know, understand, and kind of flesh out minor characters, even off the page, you know, that the reader may mm-hmm. never have access to. The writer has to know a wealth of information about, you know, the iceberg of what's underneath them that's motivating yes. their behavior. So,
definitely.
But we can get into that in a minute. So then you wrote it linearly. Did you write it because it's told chronologically pretty much with flashbacks, obviously, but
right.
But the general momentum is chronological. And I was wondering if that was kind of the way it was written as well.
That's generally how I write. And yeah. it was, there was one exception with this book. Once I nailed down the characters and the situation, I did the Kale, what I think of as the Kale Sunday origin scene. It's about a third of the way into the book. And there's just this one scene where they're in high school and they sort of take notice of each other in a different way. And for some reason, that scene just kept sort of presenting itself. So it was unusual for me, but I did kind of sit down and just finally wrote that scene and put it aside and figured I'll pull it in when it's time. But other than that, everything was, I just started at the beginning and worked my way through. And that's generally how I go because I don't, I'm not sure what's coming too far down the line. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that, and I won't give away any spoilers, but kind of midway through the book is what we come to discover is the motivation for her leaving at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of struck me as, you know, to be hard as a novelist to construct all of this without knowing specifically what was coming, you know, what motivated mm-hmm. this big shift. So then I wondered, you know, did you have some inkling of what kind of might have happened, but you hadn't written the scene out yet? And then it'd be really tempting because that'd be a really interesting scene to write. And I can just feel myself as a writer being like, I'm just going to write that scene. And then, you know, like
right.
the butterfly who flaps its wings, everything shifts everything else. So I was like, that'd be tricky. You know, it'd be tricky to not get to the inciting event until kind of deep into the novel.
Yeah, I had some, I really wasn't sure what it was going to be. You have some ideas floating around. And that's why I just, in general, I just don't write ahead. Even if I'm pretty sure a scene will be in there or this is how it should work, I might take notes and think about that. But I just know now how much things change as you go and how much you learn as you write a story. So yeah, I did not write that until I got there. And I wasn't 100% sure for a while what that would be. I just knew that it would revolve around some sort of shame for her enough that, you know, caused her to feel like she had no choice at that time except to leave.
I'm glad you bring the word shame up because I had that written all over my notes. And I think it's difficult and well done here, but the job of the novelist is to communicate a sense of, because shame is such a frequent motivating factor in family dramas.
Yes.
And communicating shame in fiction is complicated because it's so very specific to the character's experience and, you know, what their relationship was like with their parents. And as you say, there's this generational learned behavior of keeping secrets. And so just struck me how specific shame is to a given character's psyche that you could have 10 characters and they'd react 10 different ways to a situation. And so absolutely. Communicating all that is tricky. And I don't know how much consideration you had to give to that as you were working through communicating her shame.
It was tricky because, I mean, you make such a great point that in this given event in her life, everyone would have acted differently. And I've certainly had people kind of express that to me, like it's hard for them to understand her response to that situation. But for Sunday, that was kind of her particular brand of shame, I guess. That's just felt like something that she couldn't get over or be honest about. But I think for everybody, it's so different. So that was, I guess, my job. It was to try to give everybody a glimpse into that world, given the way she was raised and just where she comes from and what shaped her, that for her, that particular event is just did create that shame. But it's a great point, because so many people would react differently. And that's where it's just trying to empathize, you know, with the character and understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, so much of, especially perhaps women, I mean, I can only speak from a woman's perspective, but all of this crap gets handed so deeply down to us from our mothers, right?
Yeah.
Not to give anything away, but you also had to make decisions about which of these six characters was, you know, you can't bring in every single character as a voice. Mm. And so that decision to get to other characters, you know, her mother and other characters, kind of through the peripheral vision of her own psychology, mm-hmm. I thought was great, because if you, I don't know, if you bring in too many characters, it's turtles all the way down, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know if you had to play around with that decision about, okay, does this person kind of deserve, have they earned page time, or, you know, can I get to them just through this other character's psychology about her experience with them?
Those were definitely the questions I had to ask myself and think hard about. And ultimately, because there were people I would have loved to spend a little time with, some of the Teresa, just some of the other characters in the book, but what it came down to for me was really the point of view characters are all harboring secrets, and some, you know, deeper than others or bigger than others. But that just seemed like a great way to let the reader in on some of those secrets that other characters don't know about. So that's really what made the decision was, you know, for the most part, that's kind of where I had to draw the line in the sand, like, okay, who's holding on to secrets here? And how do we want those to be revealed? And that's where the decisions came in as far as who gets point of view chapters and who really doesn't.
One question that I was going to get back to, and this might be a good time to introduce it, is getting to know characters through their names, because the characters have very particular, unforgettable names. Kale is one, K-A-L-E, and Sunday, obviously another. And Sunday gets her homage to her name kind of in the preamble to the book through a nursery rhyme. But I think it's so important to discover who people are through their names. I mean, I just feel like I can always tell if a character is misnamed in something I'm working on, or it's important.
Yes.
You know, you can't
it's
slap
so
a name
important.
On. Yeah. So yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit about that, and about, you know, if you had different names that you were grappling with and how you knew that you had settled on just the right ones.
You know, I agree with you 100%. Names are so important. And I think they just feed the character. You know, when you nail the right name down, it just helps what you're trying to get across in that character, or it can. And in this book, honestly, most of the names are family members. And almost all of them, I think, are in Ireland. I have a huge portion of family in Ireland. Again, no one's, Denny's not based on anyone, but I do have a cousin, Dennis. We've got a Mickey and a Mora, and Grail was a family friend. And, you know, Michael's common, but there's a cousin, Michael. And the only one that's really not based on a family member is Sunday. And that was just, there was a person on TV, it was years and years ago, her name was Sunday, and it just stuck with me. And I thought, what a cool name. And it just sort of came back when I was writing this book, and early on, I just jumped on that because it just seemed to fit very well. But yeah, I definitely take time with names and think about the character, and then I'll jot a bunch down or look on the internet or just try to, you know, get some ideas. And then once I find it, you just feel like, you know, that's right. That's the one. He's a Denny. He's a Jackie. He's a, you know, whatever it is. Put a lot of time into that. Yeah.
Yeah. The psychology and the subconsciousness of Sunday, I thought was really interesting, because we know it's an Irish Catholic family. There's not a ton of religion in here, but there is a ton of Irish Catholic shame in here, as we've mentioned. And so the choice of Sunday, even subconsciously, if you're not aware of it, this kind of biblical day.
Yep.
With her carrying around this, you know, anchor of shame around her, I thought worked really, really well. And that kind of leads to the question about the importance of culture. We hadn't, you know, we've kind of touched around that, but the Irishness of this family and the culture surrounding guilt and shame and family secrets, I think is also very particular to that culture and that maybe some of that generation, but definitely that culture. And I'd just love to hear about your kind of insights. I mean, it sounds like you were steeped in this from your own family, but just kind of your own insights about how culture shaped who these characters were.
Yeah, definitely. I come from that world for sure. And like Sunday church, when I was young, I went to church with my family, but that ended a long time ago. I can't say it was a huge influence directly on my life or my brother's life. Like our generation kind of let that go. As soon as my mom said, "You don't have to go to church anymore," I was like, "Thank God, I'm done. I'm out then," you know, and that was at about 13. So it certainly was there, but she was raised Catholic and my dad was, and their parents were. And so even though, and I did go through those kind of early sacraments, like when you make your communion and things like that. But even though I didn't carry it through, that influence is strong on both sides of the family. And there were definitely things, and some of them I didn't even really think about until even after I finished the book, but things that I knew growing up, things that we just didn't talk about very much. And the older my parents, and especially their parents, and just for instance, there was my mom's mom got pregnant out of wedlock, and that was way back in the, I believe the 40s, and she came from a huge, again, Irish Catholic family, and it was a big scandal. And so there were just, and by the time I grew up, you begin to sense there's something, because there was another aunt I had, and I didn't really know her very well. And you just sense that there were things that we didn't really talk about. We talk about them now, but I think sometimes that generational sort of shame kind of trickles down. So even though the church isn't a huge part of my life, it is still that culture that I come from. So yeah, even though Sunday doesn't go to church or, you know, kind of follow those rules, that's how she grew up. And that's certainly how her parents grew up, particularly her mom. So that has a huge influence on the kids.
And you can just feel these third rails in families, right? Whether it's children out of wedlock, abortion, infidelity, sure. I'm just naming names that are third rails in families.
Right.
Even if it's never been talked about, it, you know, it bears such a strong presence in the room that there's kind of no mistaking it.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Well, that takes me back to the question that I had earlier about this wonderful way that you have of structuring the novel, which I was calling it for myself, the baton toss of point of view. For readers who have not yet read it, the end of each chapter, there is usually a piece of dialogue that is dropped in the last couple of sentences of a chapter. And that piece of dialogue is picked up by the next character in the following chapter to begin it. And for novelists who are either new or lost in their book, which who doesn't get lost in their book, I thought that was such a great way of kind of reining yourself in as novelist, of saying, okay, at least I have this this sentence that I can use as a place to start. I can't remember if I've seen that device used before. So I'll just coin it the Tracy Lang baton toss.
I like that.
tell me about inventing that. Good job.
Yeah, well, thank you. I can't say I was setting out to, I'm going to write a book and invent a new device here.
Yeah.
It was there from the beginning. And again, I really didn't know if that would stay. I didn't know if I could sort of pull it off, just because it's a somewhat limiting, just as you're trying to pass through time and things like that. But honestly, I'm pretty sure I had it in there. I know I had it in there because it did help me keep the narrative a little tighter. You know, with so many characters and so much going on, that was always my fear, was that I was going to kind of wander off or lose people, create confusion. But that line, like you said, it just gave me the next place to pick up from. And there were a couple chapters where it was a little tricky and I had to think about how to do it. But for the most part, it was just helpful to me. And that was another one. I thought at some point along the way, someone might say, I don't know, you know, if this is a little gimmicky or it's not working, but I left it in there. And, but honestly, I think more than anything, it was just to help myself keep the narrative pretty focused as I built the story.
Well, there's always some piece of writing advice, might've been by Hemingway, who said kind of stop writing early, you know, in your writing day, like if you still have more questions and you still have more in you, you know, kind of force yourself to stop. Yes. And I thought this was kind of a version of that, where it was, okay, this is such a natural place where you're going to be able to pick up and take off again. And yeah, so I just thought that was smart. Yes. Even if you had to ultimately drop it, because, you know, not every book can do that.
Right. I figured, I mean, it definitely helped me write it. And I thought, well, I'm going to leave it. And again, if it doesn't work for some reason, I can deal with that down the road. But yeah, it was so helpful in getting me going the next time I sat down or for the next chapter.
Talk a little bit about power of place and setting a novel, because I think a place can't help but be another character in a book. And, you know, if places are just so steeped in meaning. And so tell me a little bit about choosing New York and kind of what that, you know, gave to the book, and maybe some of the restrictions of what it imposed on the book.
For me, New York was such a natural place for this to take place. It is where I grew up, and I had family all over New York, from out in Long Island to the boroughs, some people up in Westchester where, you know, where these guys are. There's just such a strong Irish Catholic influence in pockets of those, of that general area. And so I knew I wanted it to be in New York, but I also knew I wanted it to be somewhat near the city, but in a smaller suburb, where the kind of place that Mickey and Maura would have looked for all those years ago to raise their family. So it just, as far as the location, it was just such a natural place for me to write about this. And I know there are pockets of Irish all over, but this one I knew pretty well. And then, of course, the pub was just a huge part of that. And again, a lot of that comes from family experience. I've had uncles in Ireland that owned pubs, and just from spending so much time over there, the family would gather. They may have been the ones that owned the pub, but everybody was there. Everybody would pitch in, help out. So that, again, just felt like a really natural place for a lot of the book to play out. So yeah, those also were there from the beginning. I knew that I wanted to base. I haven't lived there in a long time. We go back a lot. But yeah, I knew that I wanted it to take place in New York and close to the city.
It's so funny, because I talk to so many writers who write about their place of origin, you know, wherever they grew up. And I do think it's helpful to have some distance from that place so that you can see it with a new perspective, but then maybe do these little dive bomb sessions into back in there. So you can do a little sensory detail, you know, research. But having the distance from a place really allows you some perspective on it to kind of see it objectively, to write about it. I think it's hard to do that when you're immersed somewhere.
I agree. I have been gone a long time. The nice thing was, though, my dad still lived there up until just a few years ago. And so he was a great resource, because he did come from Ireland and in the 60s and worked in construction in New York City for, gosh, I guess somewhere around 40 years. So it was great, because even though I was out west, when I had questions, I could just pick his brain. And it was a fun way to include him in the story too. But he knew all the locations, and he could kind of give me some insider view into the construction business and how it used to work. And so a lot of that played into Mickey Brennan's story in particular. And that was really fun to be able to work in little pieces of my dad's story into his story. But he was like a conduit to New York, even though I was across country. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah, that is nice. My guest this morning is Tracy Lang. The book we're talking about is We Are the Brennans, published by Celadon. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let's talk a little bit about writing hard scenes, because there are a couple of scenes in here that you know, we won't give away spoilers, but they are, you know, they're painful scenes, they're pivotal scenes. And I was just talking to Amy Bender was on last week, and we were talking about setting time limits around your writing to allow yourself access to really scary places that you can do things scarier in your fiction if you know you only, you know, like touching a hot plate, you only have to stay there for a second.
Right.
And so I don't know if, I mean, there's scenes that would come to mind as a reader, but that those aren't always the scenes that come to mind for a writer. I mean, sometimes the scenes that a reader would never guess were the hard scenes for the writer to write. And so just kind of generally, if you can talk about how you approach a scene that might feel scary, A, and B, how you know if you've gone deep enough, if you've really gone all the way into the scary place for yourself.
I would say for me, what kind of scares me, I guess, the most, or one of the things that scares me the most when it comes to really challenging scene is, of course, getting the right emotion across and for the reader. But in this book, I guess in particular, it was always getting across the balance of the people in the scene, the different perspectives, because in my mind, no one in this story, just like very, very few people in life, no one's all good or all bad. They're all so flawed. And some characters are much easier to judge, you know, than others. But even the people that you would kind of judge the harshest in this book have another side to the story. And I always wanted to be trying to present that. So that for me, those scenes, like the one you referenced earlier, kind of in the middle of the book when we learn maybe what drove Sunday away, that was a really tough scene. But what made it so tough for me, there are a couple of things, but one of the things that made it so tough was trying to get across, you know, there are two people for the most part involved in that situation, and just trying to get across that there, it's not as simple as it seems, that there's different motivations that come in, and you know, some of it you learn later on in the book, but it's just always trying to get that balance that it's just, there's a little bit of gray, at least a little bit of gray. It's nothing's really black and white. So yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I find particularly difficult in some of those tougher scenes. And that would come up in the midpoint that you spoke about. It came up in scenes with Sunday and her mother. Those were also tough ones to write, to try to get across the right balance there. And those do take a long time. And I think, I don't know that I impose a specific time limit, but I'll kind of know, like, all right, the well is run dry for a while. Yeah. I got to step away and come back to this tomorrow. So that's one thing I've learned, is to kind of pay attention to that. When I feel like I'm sort of stuck, it usually means, all right, I've done what I can on this, and I have to come back at it with fresh eyes tomorrow.
I'm so glad you brought up the word judgment, because beside all the times I wrote shame, I also wrote judgment. And I think it can be difficult, especially maybe in early drafts or maybe for early writers, to withhold, you know, the writer's job is not to render judgment on their characters. It's to render them as fully realized people. Mm-hmm. And that can be, I think that can be hard for new writers, because it's so easy to, you know, reduce people to kind of black and white initially,
right,
and really ferret them out. And I don't know if you ever struggled with that. You know, if there was a character in here that you didn't particularly like, or you didn't particularly understand, or, you know, their backstory was elusive to you, and giving them the full respect of humanity, I think is sometimes really hard, in how you worked through those issues to understand characters who may have been, you know, really confounding to you.
Yeah, there were probably two or three that were tough. And I don't think it's giving anything away to just mention. I mean, again, Sunday's mom, Maura Brennan, was really difficult at times, because it would be very easy to judge a lot of things that she did and said, but forces shaped her as well. And, you know, my hope was that I got across at least some of that, you know, as difficult as she could be, there's a reason she behaved the way she did as well. Vivian was another character, you know, that was important to me, really important to me, that she not be just sort of an easy scapegoat of sorts, you know, again, without giving anything away. But yeah, there were, and even sort of Billy Walsh, who's, you know, arguably definitely a villain of sorts, he has another side to his story too. So yeah, it was just important to me. And they definitely take time. No matter what, even when it's your big goal not to do this, in those early drafts, there was a lot of almost kind of caricature, you know, and I kind of knew that. And that's where writing partners in particular came in as huge resources for me. I work with a few people very closely and they knew what I was going for. So they were able to kind of point some things out. And I knew they would evolve over time. But yeah, there were a few that took a while to just find that balance. And it's tough and you're never quite sure what you got across
right
at the end of the day. But yeah, that's what I was going for with those guys.
Do you ever write off the page for characters who would never make it onto the page? Like, would you write, you know, a couple of thousand words about, you know, from Billy's perspective, even though that will never make it into the book, to just get who he is? Or do you kind of just like mentally play through what his motives might have been?
I definitely do a little bit of writing. I know people that do writing for, like you said, characters that are never even going to appear, and like somebody's parents who aren't even in the book, but they like to do that deep dive. And right. I actually don't do that. I see why people do. There's something in me that I think there's just so, I'm so about efficiency in a lot of ways. And then, but I do think through, like, all of these characters had an arc, or almost all of them. And so I did take time to think through those arcs, even those secondary characters, just to make sure that that was coming through to some degree. Obviously the main characters got a lot more development time there, but if they're going to have an arc, I do go through those motions with each of them and think about what that is and what that's going to look like. But I can't say I do a whole lot of just free writing. I definitely take notes and ask myself some questions to come back to, but yeah, I can't say I do a whole lot of extraneous sort of just to somewhere in here is the thread kind of thing. I really like to know where I'm going when I put my fingertips to the keypad.
Keyboard. Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
And is everything organizationally pretty contained in your computer? Do you use like post-it notes all over your office, or some people use clotheslines to like see the,
right.
the different character things?
You know, I use Scrivener.
Okay.
Which I love Scrivener. It's just such a great place to keep everything in one place. I love it. But I do always have a stack of yellow legal pads, and that's where it's always just kind of sitting there. And if I'm thinking through a scene, I want to jot a few notes down, or, you know, these moments where you think, oh, here's the solution to that problem I've been trying to figure out, and I'll free write that for a little bit. So those are my main tools, Scrivener. And then I always have that pad handy. And then once in a while in the middle of the night, something will strike me. I'll type a note into my phone so I don't
yes.
lose it. So I guess I use that as well, less frequently, but those are the things I normally use.
I love the phone. Like if I'm driving yes. and I have a thought, you just like turn on the microphone and jot it into the notes. And yeah,
definitely. Yeah. I definitely use that, because once in a while, something will just strike you and you could lose it. And so, yeah, I've got either the pad or the phone that I can get it down.
How did novelists write back in the time of only, you know, quill pens, honestly?
I have thought about that once in a while. I have no idea. I can't even imagine what my pages would look like.
Right.
Yeah.
No Google
yeah,
Maps. Yeah.
No. Oh, my gosh. You can go anywhere now on Google Maps and like walk a street in a town on the other side of the country, or, you know, it's pretty amazing what we have at our fingertips now.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, the house in this book, the Brennan's house, I almost saw this. I could totally see this novel as a play, like more a play than a movie even, because it took place in these really tight, kind of not claustrophobic, but it had the feeling of kind of claustrophobia, because this family is just on top
yes.
of each other all the time.
They and, are. Yeah.
And you can just see this kitchen, and you can, you know, see these small spaces where they're invading each other's psychologies. So I just kept picturing this on the stage, but I was thinking, you know, you must have had the choreography of this house really deeply ingrained in your head, where you could just see this. I could.
No, you're right. I did have it kind of in my head, and where each room was and how it was laid out. And yeah, it's a lot of people, especially after Sunday comes back, you know, and at different times people were gone and then moved back to help Dad. And then of course, Jackie had his own reasons for moving back home. So, you know, when the story opens, they're all a bit stuck. And I think that's almost like an indication of that they're all kind of under this roof. As much as they love each other, they're kind of stuck at the moment, and they all need to figure out how to get unstuck.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You had a great essay in Lit Hub recently about making a case for family dramas. And you had, I was just thinking of this because you pulled out Ann Patchett's The Dutch House. And I was talking to her about the house. I was like, that house was such a character. And she's like, I have no idea what the house looked like. I had no image in my head. And I was like, what?
Wow. Like,
wow. Yeah. The house was the book. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Wow, that's, I wouldn't have guessed that. Yeah. I definitely had, I mean, not down to sort of specific colors or, but as far as the layout, I guess that's kind of what I felt like I had to have in my head, just maybe just because so many people were involved. It had to make sense to me in my head, but that's interesting. It felt like the house was something she'd been in or, right, you know, knew really well. Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, that was a great essay. So you had pointed out, and maybe these are some of your literary influences along the way, but you know, pointed out Wally Lamb and Ann Patchett, of course, and Jonathan Tropper. And I was wondering if, you know, I'm always interested in what writers are reading, if they try to read within their genre for, I mean, sometimes that can ruin a book if you're, you know, if you're trying to study it too deeply from the experience of just enjoying it. But it sounds like your draw as reader is also your draw as writer to these family drama books. And if you find that those help, sometimes they can get in your head, I think, as a writer a little too much.
Yeah. I do read an awful lot of this genre. And I always have. I think it just, again, my interest in people and families and relationships. So I do. Wally Lamb was huge. And I kind of read him, I think, at a, I mean, he's wonderful anyway, but I also read him at sort of, I did kind of a pivotal time. I think sometimes certain books find you at a time when and they just kind of blow your mind. And, but of course, Ann Patchett and John Boyne, Irish author, absolutely love him. And so, yeah, those, Frederick Bachman is another one that it's not necessarily family drama, but just people and relationships and what makes people tick. And again, those whole, like, everyone, there's good and bad in everyone and, or, you know, it's all gray. So those are all part of, those are all people that I just really look up to. And some memoirs like Tara Westover's memoir and Jeanette Walls, The Glass Castle, all of those. So it is what I spend a lot of time reading, but then I will definitely take time, especially after especially heavy book, to maybe read a lighter or quicker kind of crime novel. I do read across different genres, but for the most part, that tends to be what I keep coming back to.
John Boyne. Yeah. What a great, what a great writer. And that, you know, I don't know if that had influence on you. It sounds like you have these voices, that your dialogue and dialect, because you really have to inhabit, you know, these, at least these six characters, but really, I mean, there's probably more like 10 or 12 big, you know, characters that come in and out. So to inhabit their dialogue and dialect, because you do have rogue dialect. And I think that's really tricky because you don't want it to come across as, you want it to come across as authentic, but not caricaturish, right? And not making fun of their dialogue. And you got that. I thought you really got that just, I mean, I'm not Irish, but it felt like you got that just right. And
I appreciate that. That was, again, just growing up around so many Irish people and spending so much time in Ireland growing up and still in, to this day, I'm in touch with many, many family over there. And so that was a concern, but I would hear these voices fairly naturally in my head and just little words they would use and they still do. And then of course it was running it past readers and making sure it made sense. And I guess the ultimate test was now some of my cousins and family in Ireland have read it and they approve. So I guess that's a good sign.
That is a good sign. Yeah, that is a good sign.
Yeah.
Well, let's switch over to the publishing part of this because, you know, I know new writers are always hungry to hear from debut novelists about how this whole process went. So if you can talk a little bit about so it sounds like you had a trusted group of readers. And so you took the book, I guess, as far as after you finished and they agreed you had taken it as far as you could possibly take it. I assume the agent hunt began. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how all of that went down.
Sure. Yeah. I will say a big part of my experience in preparing the book to query and to present to agents was the Stanford program that I did. It's an amazing program. And I had been researching MFAs and I came across the Stanford program, which is not an MFA, but was all about learning about craft and finishing your novel. So it was kind of right up my alley, and it was remote. I didn't live there, obviously, so I kind of needed that option.
And how long was that program?
It's a 2-year program.
Okay.
It's a two years. And but it's part-time. It's designed for people that have families and jobs and other things going on. So it really was a great fit for me. And that is where I found my writing group, which, you know, some of us have been working together now for over 3 years. And at least for me, they are essential. I'm not sure what I would do without them, honestly. So that was one of the best things that came. I learned so much, but I also found this group. And we're still working with each other today. But yeah, towards the end of that experience, that program, I had an opportunity to work one-on-one with a published author, Deborah Johnson. She's wonderful. She's a historical fiction. And so she read my manuscript, and we kind of had this one-on-one time to go through it. And so she was the first real sort of professional eyes on, and gave me, just asked all the right questions. And I kind of took it to a new level. And then fortunately, I decided to attend a conference. It's the big writers conference in Kauai that is normally goes on every year, except of course the last couple because of COVID, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But in 2019, I went ahead, and again, two people from the program are going. So I thought, what the heck? I haven't been to one. I'm going to go do this. And that's where I was fortunate enough to sit down with the person who is my agent now, and just have a very brief conversation about the book. And she said, you know, this is kind of in my wheelhouse. You should send it to me. And of course I thought, well, maybe she's telling everybody that, but I went home and I worked on it for a week. I went through it one more time and sent it to her. And when she read it, she did not offer to represent it, but she gave me some great notes. And I think really what she was after was just kind of waiting to see what I could do with those notes. And so when I sent her the rewrite, that's when she said, okay, there were still more rewrites to come, but yeah. She said, okay, I'd like to, you know, represent the book. And then it did, it went through a couple more rewrites. And then after Celadon bought it, it went through one more significant rewrite. And then it kind of went from there. So I was very lucky. I did pile up some rejections, or a little bit earlier, I had sent out some query letters and people passed for various reasons. So I know the joys of, you know, querying hell, but, right. But I was super fortunate. And I think any chance anybody gets to go to those conferences and have that face-to-face time, even if you don't come out of it with an agent, you're meeting them and they are so eager to offer any assistance or guidance or answer questions that you have. So yeah, I was very fortunate and then happened to meet her at right time, right place.
Fantastic. Can I ask what a couple of her, I'm just curious what notes might look like from an agent, because, you know, if they're too significant, it could stop mm-hmm. you in your tracks where you're like, I just don't like this character. And then you're like, well, I don't know what to do with that. So yeah, can you give us just kind of an example of what some of her more significant notes would look like, and how you approached working through those?
Yeah, and I'm sure every agent, and from what I hear, every agent does have a different approach to this. With me, Stephanie Cabot, that's my agent, she sort of approaches it from here's what's working, and here's what's not. There wasn't sort of like, you need to lose this storyline or cut this character. It was more, for instance, early on, she felt like there was just a lot of male energy, and that there was kind of an imbalance, and there was just some work to do around that, and maybe giving Sunday a little more agency on the page. So that's just one example. And so then it's up to me to kind of sit with that and think about, okay, how do I approach that? And that made sense to me. I didn't have any problem with that. And it took me a little bit to sort of think it through. But honestly, one of the best things I did then was originally Denny, Sunday's older brother, had a little boy in the book. And so I gave him a daughter. And that just had this really nice ripple effect in unexpected ways that really helped change that energy. And that wasn't the only thing, but that was pretty key. So that's just kind of an example of how something that's not this massive change can end up having a really nice effect, depending on what you're going for. So anyway, back to your question, that's just an example. She'll sort of say what's working and what's not. And what she's sort of missing, but and then it's up to me to kind of figure out how to come at that, which for a while is super stressful.
Yeah.
you almost wish someone would say, oh, just get rid of this character and do this and it's all good, you know.
Right.
But in the end, I'm grateful that's how it works, and then I have to figure it out and you know, rework it. And so yeah, that's one example. That was one of the bigger notes that I got, and just that one change helped tremendously.
That's a really interesting example. And I think sometimes it's hard for writers to know. I mean, an agent is a good person to listen to, and an editor is also probably a good person to listen to. But I do think you can get so many voices in your head that it gets confusing. Like, is that a good note, or is that just particular to them?
Yes. Yeah, you have to really kind of sort through that. But at no point did I get any notes from anybody, be it my agent or the editor, that felt wrong for the book. It all felt like it made sense. I had to take some time to figure it out, but I understood why they were looking for those changes or tweaks. So as long as your gut says they're right, even if you're a little panicked about figuring it out in the moment, that's kind of what I have listened to.
Good advice. Gosh, we're drawing down on our time, but is there advice we should have covered? Things that, particularly anything that you might have learned in the Stanford program that particularly sustained you, or, you know, kind of surprising advice that you've gotten along the way that's been useful?
You know, really, it's just the support. This is such a solitary endeavor. And I don't mind that. I work well that way, but man, I really look forward to my calls and with my fellow writers. And we're all Zoom. We're kind of all over the country, so there are Zoom calls. But it's crucial to me. And there's accountability there, but also support. And when you have those weeks or days where you just feel like I'm stuck and I don't know what to do, I always know that at the very least I'll get some motivation from those calls. And it's, you know, we can hash some things out. And so that's probably my biggest piece of advice, or at least for consideration. Everybody works a different way, but I just find that connection with other writers is so, so important. However you do that, it doesn't have to be every week like I do, but just to get that feedback and keep you motivated. And that's one of the biggest things I took from the Stanford program, was not just my little writing group, but just that general support. Everybody wants to help each other out. If I need a reader, I can reach out to people and certainly find someone. And so, yeah, I guess that would be my biggest piece of advice is to just invest some time with other writers that are doing what you're doing.
How many people are in that group?
Right now, I've got three people that are super, again, we're every week. And when we finish a draft, we're swapping drafts. And we've just know each other so well now. So it works very well. But then I've kind of got a second tier group of people that we keep in touch, just not quite as structured or as frequently. Yeah. But there's still people that you could reach out to when you are a little stuck, or just you need some inspiration maybe, or cheer
right.
each other on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It is important, because you're right. It is so solitary, and you can really get caught, especially during the pandemic. You can really get caught in your own head.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a scary place sometimes when I'm having a hard time. I just need to get out of my head, or I need someone to get in there with me, to get in there with me and talk me out of it. It's just that connection is so helpful.
A therapist I used to say said, being in your brain is like wandering around a dark attic full of knives. And I said, yeah, that's right. That's true.
Yeah, it is. It's really true sometimes. Yeah. No more than when I'm kind of stuck in a sort of not sure how to fix something or where I'm going. It's a scary place to be. So
Yeah.
And no one can understand that better than other people who are doing just what you're doing. So
no, exactly right. And let us know where we can find you online. I don't know if you're doing more Zoom events where people can watch you. I know you have a wonderful website, so people can find you there. But any way we can find you and follow you, we'd love to do it.
Probably the best way is my website, tracyling.com. I'm trying to keep that current with any, which reminds me right now, I probably should add some more things to it. But any podcasts or interviews or anything like that should be posted on there. And I am on social media. I don't post a ton, but I'm on Instagram. And so if anyone's interested there, but probably the website's the most up-to-date information as far as any events coming up.
Perfect. Tracy Lang, this was such a pleasure. Congratulations on the debut, and I'll sit here and wait for the next one.
Okay. I'm working on it. So good okay, to good. Hear. Thank you so much. This was so much fun. I appreciate it.
That was Tracy Lang. The book, We Are the Brennans, is out and available now. It's published by Celadon Books. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next week. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.